age-friendly cities. The current issue of The Working Waterfront has a story about age-friendly cities by Patricia O. The other announcement, an important one, is about the Maine Wisdom Summit coming up in September. It's titled Igniting Aging Activism. This will be on September 24th at the Civic Center, the Augusta Civic Center. And you can get more information about this from the number 207-622-5330. This will be an important statewide gathering on the topic of ageism, and it's important to know what's happening in September. Now, Marilyn Gallucci, or Dr. G, as her students call her, as I mentioned, Director of Geriatric Education and Research at University of New England. We will take call-ins about 10:30 this morning. Marilyn, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you.
You're great. It's good to hear your voice. Now, I have a list of some of the topics we could cover this morning. Nursing Home Immersion Project, the Hospice Project, Balancing Act, Preventing Fall Prevention, mm-hmm. Prevention for Falls. Tell us a little about your background and how you got interested in the field of aging.
You know, Peg, that's always an interesting question. And first, let me thank you for the invitation to be on your show. This is really an honor. So I had a great relationship with my grandparents growing up. And oftentimes in gerontology, you will find that people who choose the field, it's really because they've had that positive interaction. What's also interesting in my life, I think, is that I've never equated death and dying with people being old. When my grandparents died, one at 79, one at 89, it was because they got sick. I never connected that they got old. And so I've been really fortunate to not be co-opted by society's views that aging results in frailty for all people, that it's the cause of death in all people. And I'm just really thankful that I haven't had those experiences to believe those statements, that I'm a little more critical about those statements than maybe many people.
And how about your academic background, Marilyn?
Yes. So I actually started off as an exercise physiologist, and in essence, that's where the Balancing Act came from, the falls prevention program that we designed specifically for rural Maine, actually. And that exercise physiology background just really gave me an interest in working with people as they age. And when I first came to the University of New England, which was when I had black hair, so we're talking, I know, we're going back a good 30 years now. But what happened was I came in and I started a program called BodyWise Center for Health and Fitness. And about, I think it was 90% of the 500 members that we had in this program were 60 years of age and older. And we worked with people in cardiac rehabilitation, pulmonary rehabilitation. We worked with people with hypertension, diabetes, joint replacements. We also worked with 150 different physicians, because we would get someone in our cardiac rehab program sent to us on 26 different medications and about 7 or 8 different doctors. And none of those were coordinated. Those physicians did not talk to one another, and the older adult didn't know how to manage their care. And so we would actually step in and work with these physicians. And there was one particular person I can remember. It was a miracle. They came in on 26 different medications, and by the time we coordinated the care, they were on 6 different medications. They instantly felt better. Because after six medications, you're going to start getting medications to treat the side effects of other medications.
Yes,
and that was exactly what happened for this person.
And some geriatricians say four would be the maximum. Of course, there are a lot of individual differences, but
it's amazing. It's a law of percentages is what it is. I mean, you can have interactions with two medications.
That's right, yes.
For four medications, about a 50% chance of interaction. For six medications, there's definitely going to be some interaction. So you're right, Peg.
And marijuana now. We'll have to think about our medical marijuana interacting with our pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceuticals and also over-the-counter medications, herbal medications, aside from cannabis. So, yeah, it's pretty intense if you think about it. There's a lot to keep track of, and I would say many of us are not educated in how to really critically think through what's going on here. What are the materials and compounds in these meds that are going to affect me? And that's why I get really concerned about the commercials that are on TV, because I think they really draw people in to say, oh, I want that medication. It's going to be the miracle pill. And that's not the case. It's something that we have to be very careful of in terms of working with older adults and for older adults themselves to be mindful of what they take.
And as you know, we're the only country besides New Zealand that allows those ads for pills on television for the very good reason that people will want to have something without fully understanding the consequences, or will ask the doctor for a pill and perhaps feel neglected by the doctor if they don't leave the doctor's office with the pill.
That's so true. That is so true. And not to mention, I mean, I know you really didn't want to get off of medications, but it is such a critical issue in aging.
Yes.
But physicians don't know the cost of medications.
Right.
So a friend of mine got eye drops, went to the pharmacist, and the pharmacist said 2 ounces is $230 for these eye drops.
Oh, no.
And then she said, well, I can give you, the pharmacist said, I can give you something that is equal to that will be half the cost. But a physician had no idea what the cost of medications are. So then, again, you're putting older adults at risk for having to make choices.
Yes, and the astronomical cost of some meds these days is a big issue. You mentioned your black hair. I remember you gave a talk once on gerontologists who dye their hair.
Is it the portrayal or betrayal of images? Yes, actually, you were part of that.
It was a presidential symposium at
a national conference.
I remember that.
And what was really critical about that, Peg, was at the end of that session, it was a 90-minute session, and we had a lot of audience interaction. And it happened to be a 21-year-old student who said, well, I think the key is congruence, that if you're an older adult and you want spiked purple hair and wear Prada heels and mini skirts and that fits who you are, then by all means, go for it. And I think that was just a wonderful outcome of that session, and really appreciated that came from a 21-year-old, because I think that's what we all work for, is congruence, to be really who we are and express ourselves as we feel in our hearts and within the essence of who we are, rather than going with the styles or a need to fit a certain societal norm.
That's important. Media representations of us is a whole other topic. Let's turn now to your Living Nursing Home Immersion Project.
Yes.
I know you've gotten a lot of recognition for that in Europe as well as the U.S., right?
Yes. I've presented internationally on both of the Learning by Living Immersion projects.
So tell us about them.
Peg, this is so cool. I love these programs.
Well, good. So,
and what it is, the reason why I get so excited and passionate about these is because it truly creates change for the students that are involved. So quickly, the Learning by Living Nursing Home Immersion Project, I started that in 2006, And what happened was I lectured in a medical school class here at the University of New England. I have 125 students at that time. And one student came up to me and she said, Dr. G, I want to learn how to speak with institutionalized elders. And right away, my head went into this spin. I never used the term institutionalized. That word and even facility just has this feel of some kind of prison or something unpalatable. And I looked at her, and the other thought that came to my head was, speak with older adults as you would any adult. There's really no tricks here. If somebody has dementia, they're moving along that realm, that's a little different. But overall, we should be working with older adults and talking with them as we would anybody. So I knew that was going to fall flat. And what happened was it just popped into my head, and these are the things that happened to me. I said, would you consider living in a nursing home for 2 weeks as if you were an elder resident? Mm-hmm. And that was the start of the project. We had a pregnant pause for about 30 seconds. Her eyes got huge, and then she said, yes, I would. And actually, the first nursing home that I placed the student in was in Skowhegan, Maine. And a friend of mine, Steve Marston, was the CEO at the time, and it was a for-profit home. And there is no money that changes hands in this project. So these students will take on the persona of an 85-year-old. They will not change their appearance, but they will get a diagnosis of a stroke, losing their dominant side. They need to be wheelchair-reliant. They need to be toileted, bathed, eating pureed foods, wearing Depends, nasal cannula to help them with breathing, even though it's not attached to oxygen. So everything they would write orders for, they experience. And this is startling, as you can imagine. It is a total culture shock for these students. And the key is to keep them in a home at least 10 days, and some of them have stayed in for 12 and 14 days, depending. So at the end, what has happened from this is that students, in essence, didn't want to leave, that they had connected heart to heart with the people that they lived with in these nursing homes and made friendships. And leaving them was really difficult. And these students got to understand the cultures within these nursing homes and the importance of that family connection between staff and residents in these homes, which is something that you can't teach a student when they're just going in as a medical or health profession student and visiting a nursing home for a couple hours and then leaving. They'll never understand the sense of community and camaraderie that takes place there unless you live there and you're one of the residents.
And you'd also see, I imagine, how different the residents were from each other. So yes, that if the med students thought of old people as a kind of monolithic group, that would certainly be altered by the experience of living among them.
Absolutely. And students were amazed by the resiliency of the older adults that they lived with and their ability to adapt and adjust, and in many cases, to make the most of it. And you know, Peg, as well as I do, that there is, you know, maybe you and I can go back to continuity theory. In some ways, there's this red thread that carries through our lives. And who we were will essentially be who we are when we're older. That essence will carry through. There may be some changes and adaptations and wisdom that comes with age and learning. But by and large, we are who we are. And for those people that think they're going to be terribly different when they're in their 70s, 80s, 90s, or 100s, that's not necessarily the case unless something significant happens.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. And did some of these students then decide to become geriatric doctors as a result of their experience?
And that's an interesting question because that is not a requirement. Actually, the first student that went in, Rena Joaquim, is an OBGYN physician in Portland. Some students absolutely do say, I love working with this population. But the bottom line of it is that our medical students regardless of what field they go into, oncology, orthopedics, family medicine, pediatrics, they will be working with older adults, 4 in 10 grandparents are the primary caregivers for their grandchildren. And so it will be imperative for our pediatricians to be mindful of older adults and to keep the families together by paying attention to the grandparents who are caring for the grandchild. So you can run, but you can't hide in this field. there is, it really provides added tools in a physician's toolbox to be comfortable with older adults and to understand aging. Most medical schools, Peg, only have about 5 hours of geriatrics across the first 2 years of medical school. We have 50 hours and home visits and nursing home visits as part of our curriculum. The Nursing Home Immersion Project is a research project, and it's volunteer. So the students that do it each summer volunteer. They don't get credit. They will get a research citation. And all the nursing homes and staff work for no pay. There is no money that changes hands in this project. They do get a copy of the student's journal, which can be anywhere from 75 to 150 pages long. The student writes all the way through the project.
This is so impressive, Marilyn, and I wonder if there's any chance that medical schools will have much more education devoted to geriatrics, because, as you know well, there's a big shortage of specialists in the medical concerns and the well-being of older people, not just the diseases that we get, but the ways that we can live full lives.
And Peg, you and I have read the articles that one of the best ways to have anyone be interested in working with older adults is to have them engaged with older adults. And so that's what we fully embrace here at the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine. And we have 15 other health professions programs at UNE. And all the ones that are at the university as compared to online, because that makes it a little bit more challenging, but all the ones here where the students attend classes also attend community events and have community internships with older adults, so they can, you know, bridge that seeming gap that society creates between young and old.
That's so important, to bridge that gap. And I think people who can spend time with older adults will see that not only is there a lot of variation in every way in our interests and our abilities, but younger people have the chance to learn from older adults.
Absolutely. I had one student, Peg, she's actually also went into OBGYN, but she came up to me and she asked to live in a nursing home the summer after her first year because she was afraid to communicate with her grandparents. She just didn't know how to do that. And I said, this is remarkable. You
yes.
want to live in a nursing home in order to learn how to communicate with older adults and you know, and your grandparents are right there. And I got her into a nursing home, and she was there for 10 days, 11 days, I think. And I also connected her with a gentleman who was on hospice going through the dying process. And by the time she came out of that, she was a changed woman for the better. She just was so much calmer. And actually, I had a chance to run into her. I was with a friend of mine who was getting surgery, and she was one of the attending physicians. And I said to her, what have you found that has carried through with you from living in the nursing home? And she was, oh, you have no idea. She said, voice cadence, eye contact, touch, comfort with people. Those are the things that I learned while I lived in a nursing home, and I have been able to carry that through into my career as a physician.
Well, that's a great point about experience teaching, isn't it?
I think so.
Along with academics. Faith, you want to jump in here?
Sure. I think what I love about this concept is that the transformation comes, you've basically created a method acting program for doctors, incipient doctors. It's not necessarily that they're there and they're learning how to talk with people. It's that they're putting themselves in the experience of being an older person. And I think that's hugely important.
That's very interesting. I actually love that. The method acting, that's really wonderful. That would be great in an article.
Wouldn't it? I know Faith has a degree in theater, so she can experience the theatrical dimensions of immersing your students.
And do you follow the students? Is there a follow-up questionnaire for the participants in this program?
For the longitudinal data collection, I have done that, and it's only been sporadically, actually, Faith. So, but in every case, when I have written to the students and I have a set of 5 questions that I ask them and they send back the answers, in every case, there's saturation in this, which means that the students are answering in very similar ways in terms of that this has changed how they work with patients of any age that they're with. And those 3 things that I mentioned before, eye contact, voice cadence, and touch, and actually body position is the other one, that they know to get down to eye level, to sit on a bed, to scooch down. The students have learned while they're in a wheelchair that it's really difficult to be hugged and to hug. Mm. And you lose total control because other people are moving you around and deciding what you're going to look at. And these have raised their awareness. And then, Peg, you asked about the 48-hour hospice home immersion, which is the same research methods.
Uh-huh.
The difference, there's 2 differences. One, the students are living for 48 hours in the Gosnell Memorial Hospice Home in Scarborough. It's an 18-bed inpatient hospice home.
Uh-huh.
The other difference is that the student is not the recipient of care like they are in the nursing home.
Right.
They're not a resident or patient.
Right.
They actually provide care. So they're working with an interprofessional staff, chaplains, social workers, nurses, hospice aides, physician assistants. And they're working with patients who are in the dying process. On average, people in the hospice home are there 5 to 7 days. Some have been there longer, but on average. They provide family support. And then after a person dies, they provide postmortem care. So within 48 hours, our students will experience, again, on average, about 5 deaths, any range from 2 deaths upwards of 10 deaths in 48 hours, with many admissions once a person dies, because there's usually a waiting list. Students are sleeping in a bed where hundreds of people have died before. That in and of itself is visceral.
Yes.
For the students.
Yes.
And the students are nervous, excited going into the home. And the Gosnell home really provides a home atmosphere. As soon as you walk in, I can see the students get a feeling of calm. And by the time I pick them up on Sunday, because I drop them off, they can't leave. They're there. And by the time I pick them up on Sunday and debrief, these students are, again, their life has been altered. They view dying as a part of life. They don't feel fearful of dying or death. And the stories and the connections, the hospice home is not about dying. The hospice home is about the life that people have until their last breath. And it maybe goes along with Atul Gawande's book, where in Being Mortal, he says the importance of having a person live a very good life to the very end.
To the very end. Yeah, not to be afraid of death as they might have been before. That's important consciousness-raising experience, I would think. But I have a question, Marilyn. Why is the period only 5 to 7 days in hospice? Couldn't people be in hospice? Is that because doctors aren't referring to hospice soon enough?
That's definitely most of it. Let me state, though, I mean, we're working with the Hospice of Southern Maine, which is a not-for-profit hospice, which was a conscious decision on my part.
Okay.
And they do have at least 200 people in the home hospice program, meaning that the people are remaining in their own homes and they provide hospice support for the people in their own environment. So the times that people come into the Gosnell usually is because that their symptoms can't be managed at home, and the hospice home can manage symptoms better. The other reason why people might come into the home and then go back to wherever they came from is a respite care. That's also covered by Medicare. And there might be people who are on home hospice, and their families either have to go to a wedding, or maybe they're just exhausted as care providers. And so a person could go into the Gosnell Memorial Hospice House for six days as a Medicare benefit, so the family can do what they need to be doing. And then the person would go back home again. So it just seems that this is more of, that's why we say acute care facility. So it's by and large for the people that maybe have acute symptoms and those need to be managed.
I remember something that Doris Grumbach said, it's all life until the end. It's all life. And certainly that's a way of looking at hospice that's probably more accurate than another way of looking at it as just the death beginning and carrying on in a death cycle.
And Peg, right now, and Faith too, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were there, that we are actually in the forbidden death stage in our society. We started off in the Middle Ages in the tame death, that death was expected, people were comfortable with it, children were near the deathbed, nothing was thought of it. It was a natural part of life. And from that tame death period, we have actually then capitalized on death, actually, and have also created the forbidden death. And we're trying to move into what Ellen Goodman really kind of refers to the conversations on death as the good death stage. And then Atul Gawande is saying, you know, living a full life to the very end. So there's these tweaks that are happening that we can get people to embrace death as a part of life and to try to create comfort, bring families together, and hopefully create peaceful passings.
That reminds me that I was trying to remember the name of the state legislator who sponsored the bill Death with Dignity. That passed in Maine, as you know.
Yes.
But I see that the Christian Civic League is trying to get enough signatures on the ballot that would overturn that legislation. I think, I hope most Mainers are in favor of death with dignity, but I have to admit it's controversial.
And Peg, the thing about this and many of these issues, which I know you've run into many times yourself, and that is that the bill itself, when you read it and you see the safeguards that are written in the bill, that this is just not, you know, an offhand decision that somebody makes and all of a sudden they can die.
Right.
There are many safeguards in there. So I'm on the Hospice of Southern Maine Ethics Committee, and we've met a number of times already to really look at the policies that we want to bring into the Hospice of Southern Maine regarding the Death with Dignity Act. So we've had some really spirited conversations. The bottom line in terms of hospice is to create a peaceful death, to support people through their dying process. And so I think there's, in the bill, the safeguards that are written, anybody can look it up online if they're interested, but there's ways to really ensure that this is a thoughtful decision. And as true for the other states that have death with dignity, there many of the people maybe get the medications and choose not to do that.
Good. So this would be a time to invite call-ins to All About Aging. Our guests are Marilyn Gallucci from UNE and Faith Lane from the Dorcas Library in Prospect Harbor. The call-in number is 469-0500.
And Peg, while we're waiting for a call, if I can mention one other thing.
Yes.
We now have virtual reality for medical education and other health professions education. I can get through about 30 students in the hospice immersion, 2 to 3 students in the nursing home immersion. And when we have 360 first and second year students, you know, I can't get them all through these immersion projects. The virtual reality that we're using through Embodied Labs, the student actually puts on a headset, goes into a 360-degree world of a person and assumes that person's identity and disease, if you will. So the first lab is the Alfred Lab. You become a 74-year-old African-American male with macular degeneration and hearing loss. It only lasts 7 minutes, but your hand movements, when you see them on the screen in front of you, are the hands of an African-American male, even though that's your hand movements. And this big black dot in the middle of the screen is because you, as Alfred, have macular degeneration. You actually go to the doctor's office, and you have to take a cognition test. You pick up a pencil and can write on the form, which is really difficult because, one, you can't hear the instructions because you have hearing loss, and two, you've got this big black dot in the middle of your vision, and you can't see the form. And then at the end, the doctor gives you hearing aids to correct your hearing. He can't correct your seeing at that point, but it gives the students an immersion experience sitting in our library. So not as ideal as being immersed in a nursing home, but pretty amazing in terms of our outcomes of teaching empathy. We've had 94% of our students say that they've gained increased empathy by sitting in the shoes of the person in this virtual lab.
That's a very creative change, I suppose, in education, and you must be very pleased with the potential for that.
This is a gaming generation, right? So,
yes.
So this speaks to these students, which has been really positive for us.
Now let's take a look at the fall prevention program. Is this a matter of balance in Maine?
The matter of balance is actually not a falls prevention program. Where we've designed Balancing Act in response to a matter of balance. And I knew the person, Dean Jetty, over at Boston University that actually created a matter of balance through an NIH, National Institute of Health grant. So the matter of balance is evidence-based for reducing fear of falling, and it's also evidence-based for what's called the lay leader model. They can have older adults teach other older adults how to be mindful, create some core strength. But there is really no balance exercises done in this program. The other piece of the matter of balance is that you have to go to, I believe it's 6 2-hour classes, which means that if you're in Wittapitlock, Maine, one, you have to get an instructor there, and two, everybody has to be able to drive to a location to go to these classes at least 6 times. So the team that I work with, I run a program called UXL, and that's UNE, Exercise and Conditioning for Easier Living. And we got together and we created Balancing Act. And Balancing Act is a self-taught balance program with all balance exercises, starting at the beginner level, going to intermediate, advanced, and then we call it advanced action. So you're doing balance in motion. If anyone just gets on Google and puts in Unicom Balancing Act in Google, it will bring you to the website, and all our materials are free. We have the manuals online, and we also have videos online. Now, the interesting part about the videos is we created those through a grant in working with Balancing Act with people that had vision impairment or blindness. And we also worked with the Maine Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired to create a large font manual. Those are online. They're free. Now, the videos, whether a person can see what's happening in the video or not, the instructions have been tested with people who are blind, that when they heard the instructions of how to do an exercise, they were able to recreate it without any correction. So we've really tried to make this accessible to people in Maine. And we're hoping that people will do these exercises if they're TV watchers. Every time there's a commercial, just stand up behind your couch and do these exercises.
That would be very frequent these days, wouldn't it? One news item, one commercial. One news item, one
Absolutely.
commercial.
And even brushing your teeth, doing your dishes. You know, you can stand on one foot. We also offer the manuals. We will send them out to people, but we have to charge them for the printing. We don't keep manuals on hand. And so it's about $10 for a manual. But all of that is free online. You know, if people want to print it, we're fine with that. So we don't make any money on this program. We just want to keep Maine on its pins, if you will.
On its pins. Well, that's a great resource, Marilyn, and I'm grateful to you for telling us about it. I do know that falls is one of the big issues of late life. And in Maine, with our ice and winter time, we have probably a lot of falls and some that break bones. But the fear of falling, say a little about that.
Yeah, and that is a real indicator for falls, actually.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the matter of balance, reducing fear of falling, is a critical component. What happens when people fear falling is their body tightens up, their movements become smaller, they don't take as large a step. So they narrow their base of support by taking little baby steps. You're better off really just taking a normal size step than taking these little baby steps. And you start looking down rather than scanning your environment to get more input regarding ways to remain upright. When you look down, you'll fall down, essentially. And so we're really trying to get people to feel more comfortable in their own space. It's called proprioception, knowing where their body is in their space and their surroundings, and feeling confident with their movements. That really requires good core strength. So that means the middle section of your body, good core strength. And by doing balance exercises, you actually improve your muscle tone for balance. So that's why we took the approach of doing all balance exercises within the Balancing Act program.
Say that word again, pro something?
Proprioception.
Proprioception.
Yeah. It's understanding where your body is in the space and surroundings that you're in. So your body makes these minor muscular kind of adjustments to make sure that you're staying upright and firm.
Does that decline with age? I imagine it would.
Well, Peg, the bottom line is, and this is true, you know, I'm in the fitness field. I was an exercise physiologist before. If you don't use it, you lose it. And that is true. We do not believe in the no pain, no gain.
Right.
I mean, that one's gone.
That's gone. Yeah.
But if you don't use it, you lose it is so true. And so the more that people take elevators instead of walking the stairs, the more they park right next to a door rather than parking further in the parking lot. If they bring their groceries in, it would be great if they put them on the floor, and for every can of beans they put away, just bend down, pick up the can of beans, reach up, put it away. That's all part of functional fitness. You don't need to go to a gym. You can do your gardening, your land work, your housekeeping. All of that is considered fitness.
Well, the beans on the floor, can by can, that does sound a bit labor-intensive.
It's exercise. It's functional fitness.
Well, I have some more general questions to ask you, Marilyn. Since you've been in your post at UNE in your black hair days, what's changed about aging, do you think, either the field itself or maybe aging in Maine? I know those are big questions, but I am curious about your take on those.
I'm going to, because I'm always solution-oriented, I'm going to go to the positive right away, the first thing that came to my mind, Peg. And that is, there is actually an international movement to reframe aging.
Yes, yes.
And there's the Frameworks Institute in Massachusetts that conducted research on this. And we're looking at the terms that really are more neutral or more positive to use within the aging field. And so it has always been a button pusher for me when people refer to older adults as the elderly.
Yeah, yeah.
The elderly, as soon as that L-Y goes on to a word, then it is an adjective. And when you look up elderly, it is someone or something with a significant disorder. So you're already pigeonholing someone. You're expecting loss. You're expecting disease in a person who is elderly. And in the medical field or health professions field, and actually we tend to be more of a medical field than we are health-focused, which is kind of concerning, but in the health professions field, you will hear health professionals refer to their geriatric patient, and geriatric is also an adjective, and also a person with significant disorders. So we're trying to get our students to not use the term elderly or geriatric. The most neutral terms to be using through the Frameworks Institute is older adult or older person. And they did this really neat study on the ages associated with different words. So even the word senior, according to the Frameworks Institute, really implies for the population that answered their questions, implies somebody who is less competent. If you use the term older adult, they go up in the competence scale, according to the public that were questioned.
That's interesting.
It's very interesting. And actually, I'd be happy to send you the slide that I created on this. And these are all nouns. And when I'm talking with groups, you know, doing presentations, and I show them the scale of least competent to most competent, and elder and senior down on the least competent end.
Yeah.
I said, what happens when you use adjectives like elderly or geriatric? Where do you think they are on the scale? And people are saying they're way off on the least competent end. And the ages associated with those tend to be in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, where an older person and an older adult, usually the ages associated with those two terms are anywhere from 55 to 65.
Also, adult is a positive word, certainly.
I'd like to think so.
So
I like being adult.
If we modify it somewhat by saying older adult, we're still in the realm of positive, I guess.
Yeah. And I think, Peg, to your question, the changes over the years, I'd like to think we're getting more mindful, but in terms of our society, it's a struggle. I mean, my goal in life is to change the world. You know? I mean, I really want people to embrace aging and to reframe it and see the positives of it. A good book to read that just came out by Louise Aronson is Elderhood. She actually spoke on NPR. We have her coming to the University of New England in our College of Osteopathic Medicine to get the Humanism and Aging Leadership Award on November 5th.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I wish
I would be, I won't be here for that, but I am having lunch with her in November in connection with the National Women's Studies
Excellent.
Association. I think her book is wonderful, and on another show I will go into more detail about Louise Aronson. Elderhood, it combines her personal experience in geriatrics, her background in writing and creative writing, and her critique of the medical profession from the inside is very, very persuasive.
Yes, it is. And Peg, you know from your books that we need you. We need you to keep writing and bringing out this other way, this reframed way of looking at aging, because aging definitely gets a bum rap.
And, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It does. It really does.
And this actually all started, essentially, with the first theory of functional aging, the disengagement theory in 1961, Cummings and Henry, right?
Oh, that was that study, the suburban white middle class Kansas suburban residents were withdrawing from life. And
yes.
So that's where the disengagement theory came from.
Exactly. And what they're saying is, what the theory stated was, it is mutually beneficial for the elderly to disengage from society and society to disengage from them.
Yeah.
It is gradual.
Wow.
It is inevitable.
Right.
And so if you want to age functionally based on that theory, then the ultimate disengagement would be death.
Of course.
Wow.
You know? And death doesn't even, I mean, not death, I'm sorry, disengagement doesn't even sound positive or functional.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
And that surprised me when you said elder is not considered a word that's positive, because to me, elder is very positive, but I'm looking at it maybe through other cultural perspective.
Or your own experience, too.
Yeah.
Because an elder is the wise person in your society that has lived experience that they can share. And I think our culture, our communities need those voices.
I totally agree with you, Faith, because I also feel that an elder is someone to be revered. And Peg, you know, hit the nail on the head. It depends on the culture. So...
But I can see the advantage of older adult because of the positive quality of adult. But as far as the society and ageism, I hope to talk about that in a subsequent program. It's very discouraging to think of the negative, that aging does get such a negative rap, when there are many examples all around us of people who are strong and vigorous in late life. And even if they're not, even if they have rheumatoid arthritis or fibromyalgia, they're valuable. They have rich lives. They have a good deal to offer to other people. So it's a challenge. It's like missionary work, isn't it, to challenge ageism?
It is, and you know what happens when I go into an audience again? I mean, I do a lot of public speaking, and I'll start off with, I'll say, okay, what does society say about, you know, people who are older? And right away, without hesitation, you know, they're terrible drivers, they're sexless. And I said, well, what kind of personalities do they have? And they say, well, they're grouchy. And they're, I mean, there's not even a hesitation, you know, when
right.
they answer these questions.
Right.
And I said, let me tell you something.
Yeah.
If somebody is a grouch when they're older, chances are they were a grouch when they were younger. You know, you're really not going to change that much.
That's
you know,
true.
That essence will carry through. And don't go blaming it on aging.
That's right. Remember what Lucy says in the Peanut strip. The crabby little girl of today is the crabby old woman of tomorrow.
That's it. That's it right there. I mean, of course, there are other circumstances that come in that could create these changes, but by and large, the people that have this inner fire in them, that will show through regardless of what comes their way. So
very good. I know you have a meeting at 11, Marilyn.
I do.
We'll have to say goodbye to you and to thank you very much for sharing all your insights. It would be great to have you back, and we'll just pick up where we left off today. So thanks again for being on WERU's About Aging.
Thank you for the invitation. And Peg, keep doing the work that you're doing. It is so important because you too are changing the world.
Well, thank you. That's a good thing to think about.
I've always admired your work. Faith, I hope we get to meet in person sometime, and thank you for joining in the show. And
if you're ever in Prospect Harbor, come to the Dorcas Library.
I will do that. And actually, this method acting, I'm going to be checking in on that.
Well, we'll have contact information for Faith for you, Marilyn. But
great.
Thanks again for being
thank
with
you
us.
Both.
Bye. Thank
day.
You.
Now, Faith, let's hear about senior programming, older adult programming, I should say, at Dorcas Library. Last night we had a sing-along.
We did. That's actually a multi-generational program called Sing from the Heart.
Everyone in the
community is invited to join in.
It wasn't billed as an older adult
program. No, it is not. It is
But it turned out to be.
It is. At the beginning, it is that. But that's very important, actually, because singing is one way that people can use to help keep their bodies and their brains healthy. And a good singing stance also improves your balance and keeps you on your feet. But because your brain is working through the music, the words, so you're learning new things,
yes.
You're creating new connections in your brain. You're improving your plasticity. So it's very, very good. Singing is very good for the aging process.
I suppose music, when you think of music and longevity, you think of the conductors who lived into their 90s. And
well, their entire body was immersed in the sound,
that's
right?
True.
Yeah.
But I think the importance of music in aging is a subject that needs a lot more attention. And I hope at some point to have Noel Paul Stuckey tell us about his aging experiences with music. I haven't invited him yet. So what programs are going on now there?
Well, one, Marilyn spoke about balance.
Yes.
And one of the programs that we have is on Tuesday mornings, we have a Tai Chi class at the library. Uh-huh. In the summer, on nice days, it's right out on the lawn, right next to the water.
Oh, yes.
Beautiful view.
Yes.
And people gather, they practice a very gentle Tai Chi practice, Qigong combination, and much of that focuses on movement and balance and understanding your body in space. And it also is working on your emotional energy. So where are you emotionally today? And if it's not so good,
right,
let's throw that out to sea.
Yes.
And let's bring in some new fresh energy.
Oh, that's a beautiful image, isn't it?
Yes, she's wonderful. That's taught by Heidi Eagleton.
Uh-huh.
And that's from 10 to 11. From 9 to 11 on Tuesday morning, we do have our, it is called the Senior
Coffee House.
That's Friends in Action in Ellsworth here.
Yes,
Sponsors that, co-sponsors that with us. And that's just a time for people to come to the library from 9 to 11 on Tuesday mornings and chat, have coffee, play games, bring your crafts with you, play music if you like. Some people may not have the mobility to do Tai Chi,
yes,
but they can have a social gathering every week.
That's
also important.
I didn't realize that Friends in Action was branching out to the surrounding communities. I know at the center in Ellsworth is a flourishing place, and they have concerts there, don't they?
They have many, many activities there. But I think they have also got social gatherings in Blue Hill, and I'm thinking they're trying to create one in Millbridge, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
That would be closer, wouldn't it, to us?
Yes, they're trying to support that outreach ability for seniors who live in very rural areas who can't necessarily get to Ellsworth easily.
That's
transportation.
Right.
And
that's right.
Yeah. So have some place right in their community where they can gather together and just laugh and have a good time.
I was reading recently about Uber and larger cities and Lyft, but we don't have Uber in our quarter of Maine.
Maybe one driver on the Scudic Peninsula, perhaps.
Yes, we may have volunteers, of course, but there's a whole dimension of aging in rural places, aging in rural Maine. That's a large subject, too, but part of it, I guess, would be you can't get Uber in Scudic area.
Right. So I did want to mention that Sing from the Heart is facilitated by Allison Aldrich and her husband Hunt. Allison Aldrich Smith and her husband Hunt Smith. They are a wonderful musical couple, but she's a very adept singing instructor. We sing from the heart. We sing to have joy, and we sing to merge our voices together. And you can come and sing even if you've never really been a singer, if you've always wanted to be a singer, but you never had an opportunity to learn. We are not about perfection, and we are not about performance, per se, but we are about joy of a community singing together.
And she made it clear that no experience in music in the past was prerequisite for taking part in singing from the heart. That was encouraging to me because I thought the last time I sang in a group was probably at Girl Scout camp. And then I remembered one of those songs, Allison got it, the whole group to sing to Lord.
Yeah, the people studying music and dementia know that your earliest, the things that you can remember, every word, every lyric to songs that you loved, and they use music quite often in therapy. for people with dementia.
Yes, and they try to figure out the music that was popular when you were young or middle-aged, mm-hmm. and they found that people who have not said a word for a long time will remember those words to the music right. or begin to sing the music.
Right.
That's a whole other topic, isn't it?
Yeah, dementia, I think music might be a whole show for you, Beth.
Well, I would like to get Allison and her husband to sing some folk songs about aging. I think that would be very interesting. What else should we cover, Faith? I guess we're about out of time here, but I'm very interested in your perceptions of aging in our area in Hancock County. We were saying before the show that we are one of the older counties, 44 the median age in Maine and 40...
And 50 in Gouldsboro.
50 in Gouldsboro, our area, right. too, for reasons that would be interesting to speculate on. But at any rate, the 44 is a bit misleading because it's the median age, so half the people in Maine, I like to say, are under 44, and that's a lot of younger people in our state when you think about it that right. way. We do tend to have the highest median age, but Florida, I believe, has a higher percentage of older adults than we too. You've been listening to All About Aging on WERU. Thanks to the engineer today, Amy Brown. Stay tuned for On the Wing. And next month, we'll be talking with Mary McKillop, a librarian from Ellsworth. We're looking at the subject of ageism. And we're also going to talk about aging in rural America, because whatever generalizations are true of big cities and aging have to be modified and set loose so that we can focus on what it's like to be old or older in rural Maine.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Dean Wealth Advisors, an independent